From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, why you can't get sucked down the bathtub drain, and more reassurances from the man known to calm many a childhood fear, Fred Rogers. His popular Mr. Rogers Neighborhood was the longest-running show on public television. We'll talk with him about the show, now in reruns, his own childhood, and his new book for parents. Also, a story of survival and escape in Burma. We meet Pascal Couthoué. He was part of the student democracy movement, fighting the military-led regime. He's written a new memoir. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Iraq is protesting the conditions of a UN resolution on disarmament, but it says it will comply with weapons inspections to prove that it has no weapons of mass destruction. UN Chief Kofi Annan said it's now up to the Iraqis to cooperate.
We all have to be a bit patient. The inspectors will be there in a few days, within a week. They'll be there by the 18th, and we're going to test it.
Iraq's foreign minister sent a letter to Annan accepting the resolution 2 days before a deadline imposed by the UN Security Council. Inspectors will be returning to Iraq after a nearly four-year absence. The defense attorney for one of the Washington area sniper suspects has criticized leaks to the media about the case. Anonymous law enforcement sources have claimed that the 17-year-old charged in the shooting spree confessed to carrying out some of the shootings. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports.
Peter Greenspun is the court-appointed attorney for the older suspect, former soldier John Allen Muhammad. He and Lee Malvo are being tried in separate jurisdictions in Virginia, but Greenspun called the alleged leaks misleading and harmful to both cases.
I think there are cowards in law enforcement who, despite all the information that was put out in this case, wanted to taint this jury pool, wanted to seal the public opinion in this case.
Greenspun did not say whether he would seek a change of venue for Muhammad. The Washington Post reports police are now investigating a third man for a possible connection with the shootings. He was arrested last week and reportedly spent time with Muhammad and Malvo in Antigua before coming to the U.S. last year. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Manassas, Virginia.
The close U.S. Senate race in South Dakota has been decided. Republican candidate John Thune said he would not seek a recount, putting an end to his bid to unseat the incumbent Democrat, Tim Johnson. Kurt Nikich reports from South Dakota Public Radio.
The official tally, certified Tuesday, gives Democratic Senator Tim Johnson a 524-vote advantage. The difference falls within the range that would allow the Republican candidate, John Thune, to ask for a recount. Thune says he thinks there were some irregularities during last Tuesday's election, but he doesn't think a recount or legal challenge would change the outcome.
My conclusion is that it would not be helpful, and therefore I've decided that it is in the best interest of South Dakota for me to accept the results as they stand today.
The close race here had been seen as one of the GOP's best chances to take control of the Senate from South Dakota's other senator, Democratic leader Tom Daschle, but Republicans had already won enough seats to do so before this race was even decided. For NPR News, I'm Kurt Nikich in Sioux Falls.
In stocks today, the Dow gained 12 points to close at 8,398 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq gained 12 points. This is NPR News. Federal regulators have given permission for Comcast Corporation to acquire AT&T Broadband in a deal worth an estimated $29 billion. The deal was approved over the objections of consumer groups who said the combined company would have 40% of the nation's cable market and 30% of its pay television market. The new company would have more than 27 million subscribers, almost twice as many as the number two cable company, AOL Time Warner. The companies have said the acquisition would eliminate about 1,700 jobs. A tanker with 77,000 tons of oil is in danger of sinking in a severe storm off the Spanish coast. Emergency crews are working to prevent an environmental disaster. Jerome Sokolovsky reports from Madrid.
An oil slick is already forming around the vessel, although it's not clear if the leakage is from the ship's own tank or from the enormous cargo. The tanker is just off the coast of the northeastern Spanish region of Galicia, and it's listing heavily as gale-force winds whip up waves 20 feet high. The crew has been rescued, but the captain and two lieutenants, together with emergency craft, are now trying to get the vessel away from a coastline dotted with nature reserves. Almost exactly 10 years ago, this coast suffered severe environmental damage when a tanker carrying the same amount of fuel exploded and covered 140 miles of beaches with an oil slick. For NPR News, I'm Jerome Sokolovsky in Madrid.
Federal Reserve Chief Alan Greenspan says the latest cut in interest rates should help the economy start accelerating. Greenspan said the economy should recover in 2003. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing Novasoy brand isoflavones to consumers throughout the United States, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. Even if you didn't grow up watching Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, you probably know your way around it pretty well. From 1968 on, it's been that otherworldly oasis on public television, where the kind man in the cardigan talks to toddlers about their feelings, their fears of the dark, and takes them on trips to see how crayons are made. And then there's the neighborhood of make-believe, a land of puppet shows and mini-operas, populated by King Friday the 13th and Lady Elaine. With his sneakers, his absolutely sincere and leisurely speech, and the unabashedly corny songs, Mr. Rogers invited parodies, and there were many. But as the novelist and Mr. Rogers fan Richard Ford once wrote, who but a hardened criminal wouldn't like Fred Rogers? Last year, after 33 years on the air, Fred Rogers taped his final episode, but the show lives on in reruns. He continues his work with children through his nonprofit organization, Family Communications, Inc., and he has a new book on understanding the young child called The Mr. Rogers Parenting Book. Fred Rogers joins us today from his studio in Pittsburgh. You should know he's sitting at his piano. Fred Rogers, welcome to Fresh Air. It's such a pleasure.
Thank you, Barbara.
You write about a lot of everyday things. You also write about some pretty profound issues in parenting, about children's fears. I'm remembering a show you once did about how a child cannot go down the drain in the bathtub. You had a whole show about that.
Yeah.
It sounds funny, but you're really meeting kids on their own level. That's a real fear. Did a child write to you, and is that where you got the idea for that?
A child played that out in front of me one time. Making a character, trying to see if that character could go down a tube, you know, just a plain ordinary tube. And I found out that it had to do with the drain in the bathtub. That child was petrified when his parent pulled the plug while he was still in the tub. And so consequently, we wrote a song about that, you know. You can never go down, can never go down, can never go down the drain. And then it goes on, you're much bigger than the water, much bigger than the soap. And it's true, but children don't know that when they hear this loud rush of the flush of water in the bathroom. They think they might be sucked down the drain. And so just to talk about it, people were very surprised that I would show a bathtub drain as well as a toilet drain and just say, you see, you could never go down such a small thing. Well, there were many children, I think, who breathed a sigh of relief just to be able to talk about it.
Can we talk about discipline? For a moment, you hear a lot that parents aren't disciplining their children enough now, that they're not setting limits and they're not being consistent about rules that they do have. Is that your experience looking back over your long work with kids? Are more parents dropping the ball on disciplining their children?
You know, Barbara, discipline is a kind of love. If children didn't have limits from those who cared about them, they would never feel that they were loved. If a child ran out into the street, for instance, and nobody screamed and says, come back, or nobody ran after that child, that child would think that nobody loved him. So healthy limits, which children understand, are a marvelous way of saying, I care about you. I don't know about the numbers of people who give comfortable limits to their children anymore. I know that my grandchildren receive them all the time. But things that are clear, if children know why we're asking them to do things, they often are very happy to do them, especially if they feel that it is consistent with our family values. Children love to belong, and if they know that this is the way our family does things, then they'll want to be part of it.
At the end of the day, and I mean that both literally and figuratively as a parent, what I find hardest is not losing my temper. Now, you at least, as Mr. Rogers in the neighborhood, never lost your temper. But were you like that as a parent? You had two sons. You know, after a long day in the neighborhood, what would set you off?
You know, I have a very modulated way of dealing with my anger. And I never felt that it was to anybody's advantage to scream and yell at people. I think, you know, sure, I'd get angry. But there were ways that I had of dealing with my anger. Like a... I'd go to the piano and let it out. And also, I'm a daily swimmer. And I notice that people who have a regime of exercise have wonderful ways of dealing with their feelings. And I don't mean that it's not appropriate for people to express anger in loud ways. But I am saying that it doesn't help anybody if you don't let them know through words. I mean, children are going to mimic what the adults in their lives do. And so the kinds of ways that you have of expressing your anger will probably be the kinds of ways that your children will express theirs. And that's not all bad. But I do think that it's very important for us to be upfront with our children and give them words for their feelings. That's why... What do you do with the mad that you feel when you feel so mad you could bite? You know, that's one of the songs we sing on the neighborhood a lot. Anger can be very frightening.
Now, somewhere I read that your wife said you were always so incredibly stoic and patient with your children, but that she yelled like a fishmonger. So she ended up being the disciplinarian, the ogre.
She was never an ogre. And those two sons of ours are crazy about her. In fact, she's off playing a concert right now in Atlanta.
She's also a pianist, a concert pianist.
She is. She's part of a two-piano team. But Joanne is a very real person, and she would never have been an ogre. She would have been upfront with exactly what she thought, told the kids, okay, that's it, cut it out, you know, and she gave them very comfortable limits. So they knew what was acceptable and what wasn't. And I backed her up.
Fred Rogers is my guest. He's the longtime host of the children's television show Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood on PBS. I have to ask you about the sweaters, and I'm sure you were asked about the sweaters that you wore on the show many, many times. But I understand your mother knitted most of them until her death.
She did. Mother was a great knitter. She would carry her knitting bag wherever she went. And she made a sweater a month. And at Christmas time, she would give 12 sweaters to this sort of extended family of ours. And invariably, she would say, okay, here's your sweater for Christmas, and here's the pattern book. Tell me which one you want for next year. Of course, I know the one Freddie wants. He wants the one with the zipper down the front. Well, I have all of those sweaters, and we used every one that she ever made for me. But that's been kind of a trademark, hasn't it, the sweater and the sneakers. And the sneakers came about because I had to run across the studio floor to get from the puppet set to the organ when I was doing the children's corner. And so the sneakers just became, I didn't want to make a lot of noise by running in other shoes.
I'm speaking with Fred Rogers. He's, of course, the longtime host of the children's television show Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood on PBS. He has a new book. It's called the Mr. Rogers Parenting Book. Fred Rogers, we're going to take a short break, and then we're going to talk some more. This is Fresh Air. I'm talking with Fred Rogers, the longtime host of the children's television show Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood on PBS. What were you like as a kid?
I was an only child for 11 years, Barbara. And I had to make up a lot of my own fun.
I think you were sickly often, right? You had a lot of childhood diseases?
I had every imaginable childhood disease, even scarlet fever. And so whenever I was quarantined, and you know, they used to quarantine people for chicken pox and all of those things, I would be in bed a lot. And I certainly knew what it was like to use the counterpane as my neighborhood of make-believe, if you will.
You mean
I had puppets...
The window? You would use, what, finger puppets or shadow puppets or what?
And things on the bed. I would put up my knees and they would be mountains, you know, covered with the sheet. And I'd have all these little figures moving around and I'd make them talk. And I can still see my room. And I'm sure that was the beginning of a much later neighborhood of make-believe.
Was King but Friday the 13th one of your childhood characters, or Lady Aberlin, or Lady Elaine?
The king probably had his genesis there, but it wasn't that particular name, because it was a child who helped us form that name, King Friday the 13th. A child had been told that Friday the 13th was a very bad day, and he was afraid of those Friday the 13ths. And so I just said one time, why don't we have a character whose name is Friday the 13th, and he celebrates his birthday every time a Friday lands on the 13th.
Oh, that's
of the
so
month.
Unfair.
and so his birthday King Friday's birthday is always every Friday the 13th. And I hear from people all over the world. You know, it's a joyous occasion for us. It might be otherwise for those who haven't been enlightened by the neighborhood. But
this is King Friday the 13th. I must explain a few things to Miss Beebe.
Yes, you're certainly welcome, King Friday.
Friday the 13th is a fine day, and may you not say otherwise. Thank you.
Oh, it's taken me back.
This is Lady Elaine Toots. You ask about me, and I'm mighty glad you did. Have you ever been to my museum go-round? Well, you'll find everything that you could ever want in any one of those rooms.
Oh, this is X the Owl. You seem to be speechless, Barbara.
That's so true.
I'm just flying around here looking for you. There's Daniel Tiger over at his clock. Did you want to say hello to him? I mean, he's awful shy.
Well, I am shy, but I would like to say that I'm glad you're having fresh air.
Oh, thank you for that. So is that how you spent the weeks when you were in your bed as a kid, making up voices?
Yeah, voices for puppets and all kinds of stories. And then when I was 11 years old, my sister came, and then I wasn't an only child anymore.
Now, I think I also read that you were overweight as a kid. Did kids make fun of you? And is that part of what made you kind of a sensitive guy before it was fashionable?
Yeah, maybe so. When I was probably in the fourth and fifth grades, I was really quite fat. And it's the same way with my older grandson. And just recently, he did the same thing that I did when I started adolescence. And he's just turned 13. He grew so fast and so tall that he is now quite thin, just the way I am. You know, I weigh 143.
So did you have ways of coping with being the outsider kid? Or I mean, it sounds like you were probably shy because of this.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I think I'm still shy. I was concerned about coming to talk with you today. I want things to be right. I want them to be good. I worry if I make big mistakes. And that's quite a burden at times. But of course, it can help when you're doing work that you feel is so important.
When you were in college, you studied music composition, and you also got a degree in child development, and you became an ordained Presbyterian minister. But after all those trying out, I guess, all those avocations, you went back to TV after that. Why didn't you pursue any of those other interests, music or the ministry?
Well, I feel that it's all wrapped up in what we do with the neighborhood and what we do with all of the things that we publish, that every part of who you are comes out in whatever assignment you have. But when I was ordained in the church, the ordination read like this: you are to continue your work for families and children through the mass media. So, you know, what better than to have these different identities and be able to to wrap them all in the service of children and their families. I think that that's when I really knew who I was. When, I loved drama and I loved music and I loved puppetry and I liked television and I liked philosophy and religion. But the moment I realized that all of those could be used in the service of children and their families, that's when I knew who I was.
Now, did you have a model for your Mr. Rogers persona, the perfect adult, and someone you knew, maybe your father, your grandfather?
Well, my grandfather McFeely used to say things to me, the kinds of things that I would say to the children on the air. We would visit him at his farm. Every Sunday we'd go out there for dinner.
McFeely as in Mr. McFeely on your show.
Exactly, yeah. And that's my middle name. And that was my mother's maiden name. But we would go to his farm for dinner on Sunday, and invariably he'd take us for a walk around the grounds and say things like, I'm so glad that you come. And when we leave, he would say, you've made this day a special day. Things like that, you know, that just your being yourself is what matters to me. And he would take me fishing, and he was a wonderful person.
Fred Rogers. His new book is the Mr. Rogers Parenting Book. We'll continue our conversation in the second half of the show. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Daedalus Books. Overstocks of books and CDs on the web at saleboks.com or 1-800-395-2665 for a catalog. And by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, pranks and spoofs. We continue our conversation with Fred Rogers about his popular children's show on PBS. He has a new book for parents. Also, fighting for democracy in Burma. We meet Pascal Kuthwe. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. Let's continue our interview with Fred Rogers. After 33 years hosting the children's show, Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, on PBS, he taped his last episode last year. Now the show lives on in reruns. This summer, Fred Rogers received a Presidential Medal of Freedom Award for his work with children. He has a new book, The Mr. Rogers Parenting Book. You worked with the people on your show for decades. Many of them stayed for decades, right? And I was thinking that when people work together on a television show for so long, they often play some practical jokes on each other on the air just to keep things interesting. What kinds of pranks happened on the set of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood? Did they ever sprinkle itch powder in your sweater or anything?
No, but there were times when they put rolled up newspaper in the toes of my shoes so that when I was singing the goodbye song, I would try to get on my shoes, and of course they were much too small for me to get into. So the camera didn't show the shoes those days, and I was going out with my heels over the backs. And then one time there was this blown-up, voluptuous lady made out of rubber in a huge one in my closet when I opened at the end of the program to put my sweater back in the closet. Here was this lady waiting for me.
What did you do?
We taped it over. But you couldn't do that in the days of live television, and of course that's the way we began. We began a daily program, an hour a day, live, and we did that for 8 years. And that was called The Children's Corner with Josie Carey. And I did the puppets and the music for that program. And it was all ad-lib and live. And a most wonderful way of learning how to talk when the red light went on.
I have to get you to tell this story. I understand once the actor Michael Keaton was on your show. You had many celebrities on the show, but he made a little bit more mischief than most.
Michael worked with us on the studio crew before he ever went to Hollywood. And he was in charge of the trolley, the movement of the trolley in my room, and also picture-picture. And so there's a little sliding door right under picture-picture where I put in the tape. And so
this is the magic picture projector, right?
It has a
projector, slot.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And one day I opened the slot to put the tape in, and I heard this voice say, "I'm ready to hear your confession, son." Well, that was Michael. And those are the kinds of things that he's just a wonderful person.
There have been many spoofs of Mr. Rogers, as I'm sure you know, over the years. Eddie Murphy's on Saturday Night Live is perhaps the best known spoof. I remember National Lampoon also had a skit based on your show. What did you think of those? How did you feel about the ribbing you got over the years?
I think most of them were done with a great deal of affection. I remember meeting Eddie Murphy for the first time over at the RCA building. And he came out of his office, and I was walking down the hall, and he put his arms around me, and he said, "The real Mr. Rogers." And Mr. Carson, when I was with him one time, he said, "You know, Fred, we would never do these takeoffs about you if we didn't like you. We wouldn't care about making you famous." There have been some that have concerned me, though, Barbara. And one we learned of, and this was on local television, somebody dressed up in a sweater and sneakers and talked. They said even more slowly than I talk. I did not see this, but he pretended that he was I, and he said, "Now, boys and girls, I want you to take your mother's hairspray and your daddy's cigarette lighter and press the buttons together, and you'll have a blowtorch." Well, he was meaning to be funny, you know, but it was done in the afternoon, so if any child, even one child, would have gotten the notion that that was something that we had condoned and had tried such a thing, such a sexist thing, for one thing, that would have been disastrous. And so we were able to know about that because a family that watched the neighborhood wrote to us and told us about it. So we got it taken off the air.
It's been wonderful to have you at the piano while we've been talking. Perhaps you could sing something for us or play something for us. Maybe not necessarily a children's song, but something you play for your enjoyment to take us out.
Such a good feeling, a very good feeling, the feeling you know that we're friends.
Oh, Mr. Rogers, thank you so much for talking today on Fresh Air.
Thank you, Barbara. Wish you well.
Fred Rogers. His new book is the Mr. Rogers Parenting Book. Coming up, A Burmese Odyssey. This is Fresh Air. To understand just how far Pascal Couthuè has journeyed in his life, you have to know where he began. Couthuè grew up a member of the Padang tribe in the small settlement of Pekong in southeast Burma. The Padang have a complex belief system, which is a blend of Catholic, Buddhist, and animist traditions. Living on the edge of the jungle, the tribe members hunt and farm. Padang women are known for their custom of wearing many brass necklaces, which make their necks appear elongated. In 1988, Thuy left his village to study English literature at Mandalay University. At the time, Burma was in the midst of a nationwide rebellion against the socialist government, a military dictatorship headed by General Ne Win since 1962. Thuy became a student agitator and eventually fled to the jungle with the authorities after him. He trained as a guerrilla soldier in rebel camps on the Thai-Burmese border, and eventually he escaped to England. He tells his story in the new memoir, From the Land of the Green Ghosts. I asked Thuy what his experience was of the insurrection in Mandalay in 1988.
Personally, when it started to happen, I wasn't interested in those things at all. And then, unfortunately, my girlfriend was involved in that. And then she was arrested and raped and murdered. And I also witnessed the shooting of monks and civilians who were protesting peacefully on the streets of Mandalay. And these experiences made me feel very, very outraged. So what I did was I simply said to myself, I have to do something to help my people. So I went home and I told those things to my villages, and they asked me to become their leaders to rally for the students throughout the country. So we kind of organized this type of do-it-yourself pro-democracy rallies. And we were threatened with machine guns again. And by 1988, August or September, there were 3,000 students and monks and civilians were killed on the streets of Burma. And then the military coup happened by September. So I had to flee my hometown and went into the jungle.
How did you know that you were in danger, that you personally were in danger when you fled?
I found it out through a radio communication in my village. What happened was, you have to remember that Burma still has only two or three official radio stations. So radio, what your frequency of the channels are all free, almost inside Burma. So what I did was, after listening to Burmese news or the VOA or the BBC, I used to kind of play with the radio. And one day I kind of caught this police communication line, and I heard the name of my friends and then my name saying that they were going to arrest us. And only then I realized how serious I was in. And also, what happened, one of my uncles was on the side of the military government, so he also threatened to shoot me if, you know, he saw me again, this sort of thing. So I had to kind of leave straight away. And then, sure enough, as soon as I left, they were on my trail to the Thai-Burma border, so I had to kind of be very quick to escape from them.
Well, you were traveling with a few other students to the Thai-Burma border, where you'd heard there was a rebel army in training. Yes. What was that journey like?
I had to flee with my friends 3 or 4 nights without sleeping. And we never knew where we were going either, because we had no maps, we had no proper guides. And sometimes, even when we had guides, we would be surrounded by Burmese troops and we had to break out from them. We didn't have any really substantial weapons to defend ourselves. So what we did was, we kind of thought, okay, let's play a Russian roulette here. If I manage to escape and you don't, I will tell your family that you die there. Or if I died, you tell my family that, you know, I die somewhere there. So let's do it. And then sometimes when we were hiding, we couldn't hide anywhere in the villages or the areas that would be safe. So all we could do was, we went into these kind of places that the army wouldn't go, which used to be cemeteries, because the Burmese soldiers or people used to be very afraid of cemeteries.
I thought it was so interesting that you write of this journey that you found it was impossible to force your body to climb the mountains and go through the jungle that you were trekking through if you only thought of your fear of death. If you thought of the dangers, you got exhausted.
Yes.
But what did work to motivate you then or give you energy to go on?
I kind of said to myself, you know, Pascal, you had to be free. You had to be alive. And when you are free and alive, you must tell the story of your friends to the outside world. And also, I'm really, in a sense, I'm very much kind of believe in all these spiritual connections, both religiously, both just to do with traditional sense. So I believed that angels and the spirits of my ancestor looked after me. So I have this trust that, you know, they are protecting me, and I will escape, and I will one day be able to tell people what happened to my friends and my countrymen.
You reached the rebel army camp on the Thai-Burma border, and you immediately started military training with other students. How much fighting did you end up doing on the front of this guerrilla war?
I mean, in fact, I didn't really a fight at all, because I wasn't really keen to fight. At the same time, I wasn't a very good fighter. So what I did was, I did learn to you know, train myself to be a fighter. What happened was, in the end, I was so accident prone that they said, okay, Pascal, what you need to do is you have to just look after our wounded friends and friends who are ill and trying to find the supplies for you.
You write of the hardships you encountered along the route. What did you eat, and how did you survive?
Mostly we had to depend on the jungle animals and vegetables. Most of the time were vegetables and other plants that we could get hold of. But we did have regular supply of rice from Thailand. And most of the time we had to eat boiled plants. And also sometimes if we were lucky, we could get animals like pythons, jungle fowl, snakes, moles, frogs, and fish. And my favorite was, jungle fowl. And we used to cook jungle fowls with marijuana sauce.
And marijuana sauce?
Yes, we did.
So that grew everywhere?
Yes, it was kind of grown very wild, naturally or wild. So we had to kind of use them because we didn't have a normal type of herbs that area. But we were not allowed to smoke marijuana, though, because the rebels who control the area were very devout Baptists. So one is not allowed to drink. One's not allowed to drink this kind of drug-related plants or however useful. But we were allowed to cook marijuana plants. So we kind of used those plants to cook our meat. And also help us a lot because we used to have this kind of tension after each fighting and each escape. Everyone was tense. Everyone was on the the nerve was very jungly. So what we did was we just stuff the birds or animals that we could get with these herbs and cook them. And once we have that, we were a bit more relaxed. The eating situation was the worst thing. And sometimes we have these delusion. That was the most dangerous time when you didn't eat properly, you didn't sleep properly. And sometimes you thought that your friends were your enemies. So we faced lots of these kind of hardships. But I think our friendships, comradeships, kept us very close together. And we managed to survive in the jungle.
I'm speaking with Pascal Kuthwe. He was born a member of the remote Padong tribe of Burma. He was a student in Mandalay during the insurrection against the military regime in 1988. Afterwards, he was a fugitive in the jungle and a guerrilla fighter against the government. He fled to England in 1989, where he has since graduated from Cambridge University. Now he has a memoir of his journey. It's called From the Land of the Green Ghosts. Pascal, we're going to take a break now, and then we'll talk some more.
Okay.
This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Pascal Kuthwe. He grew up in a remote village in Burma and was a student during the insurrection in Mandalay in the late 1980s against the oppressive military dictatorship there, first as a student rebel and then as a guerrilla fighter. He now lives in England. His new memoir is From the Land of the Green Ghosts. You decided to make an escape from Burma, and you wrote a letter to an Englishman, an English professor you had met in the restaurant that you worked in while you were a student in Mandalay, Dr. Casey. Mm. You described the conditions in the camp, which were then pretty bleak. You'd had many bouts of malaria, sickness. Disease was rampant. So you wrote him a letter. What did he respond?
I mean, his response was, he just said, you know, I'm sorry to hear that you are in trouble, or to that effect. But I will do my best. And that's all he said. And then with that letter came a parcel. I think there were two books, at least I remember. One was the Oxford Book of English Verse, and then the other one was Henry James, I think, A Portrait of a Lady. So when I flicked through the English book of verse, I found that there were about $120 in different denominations. So I thought, what was it? And then a couple months later, he said that he was coming to visit me on the Thai-Burma border. And then I waited for him at a hotel, and he said, would you like to come down to Bangkok with us, because we want to talk to you, sort of thing. I said, why not, you know? So once I was in Bangkok, they said, would you like to go to England and study? I said, oh, that's very kind of you. I'd really love to. So that's how it started.
You've lived in England since you arrived in 89, and you've gone to Cambridge University, gotten your degree there. What kind of contact have you had with your family?
The first thing I did was I sent them a postcard and saying to them that I'm still alive and well, but not anymore in the jungle. I'm in England. So later I was told that they celebrated a kind of Thanksgiving mass for me, because before that, they were told that I was killed by Burmese soldiers on the border when they attacked my camp. When they heard that I was alive again, and they had that celebratory mass, and then they wrote to me saying that, you know, or you should work hard, please don't come back to your country yet, because things are not very good, and if you come back, they are surely at least going to arrest you and torture you to death. So be, you know, brave and be happy wherever you are, and we will still remember you. But eventually I didn't contact them, partly because I was worried, I'm still worried, that they would be prosecuted or being interrogated for my actions.
You left Burma in 1988, and since then, the military government has continued its campaign against the pro-democracy movement, which is headed by Aung San Suu Kyi, and which won elections in 1990. She had been under house arrest since before the election, but she was released this spring, and that was hailed as a huge step for the Burmese independence movement. Did you view it with that much optimism, and what do you think has changed in Burma in the wake of her release?
Her release is a very good news, and also it did raise the optimism among Burmese people. But I think the military is deliberately delaying these talks and negotiations with the opposition groups. So I don't think that things have changed much for the country. And every Burmese people know that what's wrong with Burma, that it is the mismanagement of the country's affairs. And inside Burma, the people who are really working hard are people like Aung San Suu Kyi and other political parties who are trying to do decent things, trying to help people. But they are still being arrested and imprisoned in Burma, sometimes killed. So my feeling is, they really don't, they haven't improved the people's situation. So what Burma needs is the coordinated pressures from international communities to help Burmese people. I mean, several things. Could be sanction, could be diplomatic dialogues, and could be other things that could bring Burma back to this normality. And the last time I visited the refugee camps on the Thai-Burma border, I saw many people are still fleeing from Burma.
What were you doing in the camps on the Thai-Burma border?
I always go back there to get closer to my people, if I could afford to. And I always want to learn what is happening to my country from close quarters. And also, many of my friends, student friends, who left with me in 1988 are still living there. And some have died, some are still imprisoned sometimes by the Thai authorities for entering Thailand illegally.
Can I ask you what you miss most from your home?
Many things, I think, but it's difficult to say. But I do miss the people, I think, because this feeling of wanting to be with your people is in it in everyone. And the feeling of, you know, belonging to your people and also suffering with them, enjoying with them, that is very much missing. And I also miss, I think, that this kind of climate, very much kind of warm weather, I think. That's what I really miss about it.
Pascal Clouthouet, I want to thank you so much for talking with me today.
It's a pleasure.
Pascal Clouthouet's new memoir is The Land of the Green Ghosts. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, and Anne-Marie Baldonado, with Patty Leswing, Jessica Chu, and Ian Chillog. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Delta Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Parachute Infantry, an American paratrooper's memoir of D-Day and the Fall of the Third Reich by David Kenyon Webster, available in paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the comic book artist who turned Batman into a brooding, tortured vigilante. We meet Frank Miller. His popular remakes of the Batman comic, The Dark Knight Returns and The Dark Knight Strikes Again, are now available in hardback. I'm Barbara Bogave. Join us for the next Fresh Air.